from sunny St. Leonard's on the south coast of the UK. This is the Keto Woman Podcast, brought to you by me, Daisy Brackenhall. Hello, keto lovelies, and welcome to episode number 202, where I am joined by Janine Davenport. If you've been listening over the last few weeks to the introductions, you will have heard me mention her a few times. She's the lady who's been helping me with Rocket and his anxiety problems. And thanks to her and her advice, he is doing much, much better. He's not all the way there yet, but I would say he's a good 80% at least back to his old self. So things are looking much, much better for him. I'm a bit late getting this episode out to you, and I'm sorry about that. I'm recording this on Saturday evening. I've had a hideous migraine all day, so my plans to get the edit finished this morning and get it loaded and out to you fell by the wayside. What I've also decided to do is to split the episode into two parts. It was quite a long recording, and what with the migraine and being late in getting that recording done in the first place, we only recorded yesterday lunchtime. I thought it better to get out the first half that I've edited already so that you've got something to tickle your earbuds with. There was also a convenient break when we stopped talking all about dogs and went on to Janine's low-carb sugar addiction story. It probably won't come as any surprise to you that we spend a lot of time and all of today's episode talking about dogs. You know me, you know how important my dogs are to me, and Janine's world is all about dogs. She now has her dream, her own rescue called Five Circles Dog Rescue, and you can find the link in the show notes. I feel I should warn you that we do talk about some very distressing things when it comes to the Spanish rescue dogs. I had some knowledge of the way they are treated, but I was pretty horrified with the images that Janine conjured. And so if that's the kind of thing that is going to stay with you and be too distressing, then you might want to skip ahead at that part. What I'm going to do is put a heads up in the episode just before we start talking about that so that you can skip forward a few minutes and miss that if you want to. And I completely understand if that's something you want to do. I can remember watching a program about how dogs were treated in Southeast Asia once, and I saw images that I immediately wanted to unsee, but of course I couldn't. Once I'd seen them. And once you hear a description, you can't unhear it. So I just wanted to warn you, if that's the kind of thing that is really gonna upset you, then just skip ahead. But it is an important part of the story, and you will understand why helping these dogs became such a passion of hers. Nothing overly exciting has been happening this week. The sun has been shining quite a lot, which is nice, and we are promised a heat wave next week. I'm not going to hold my breath because we've been promised that before, but we shall see. The weather does look nice, so I'm hoping to get some really warm, sunny swim days in before the weather starts getting all autumnal and wintry and the sea gets really cold. I think, as I've mentioned before, I'm actually quite looking forward to that because it is pretty exhilarating. But I don't want to wish the sunny weather away just yet, and hoping to enjoy some lovely sunny days next week. I ended up having a wonderful sunset swim yesterday evening. I went down quite late and realized that the sun was going down, and it was one of those beautiful sunsets when the sun is huge and you just watch it gradually dropping down behind the buildings. And I did that treading water in the sea. So that was a really nice surprise for yesterday evening. Apart from that, it's much of the same. Until yesterday, of course, when I saw on my newsfeed that ABBA are back. ABBA are back with a new album after 40 years. How exciting is that? If you're an unashamedly out in the open ABBA fan like I am, it's really exciting. And I've been listening to the two new tracks and can't wait for the new album in November. So that's probably the pinnacle of my excitement from this week. I hope wherever you are, you're enjoying a warm and sunny and fabulous weekend. And I hope you enjoy this first part of my conversation with Janine, where we talk about dogs, and in particular, rescue dogs, of course. If doggy chat isn't your thing, then drop back in next week when we'll be going on to talk about Janine's keto and low carb story and her battle with sugar addiction. But for now, let's get on with the first part of my chat with Janine Davenport. Welcome, Janine, to the Keto Women podcast. How are you doing today?
Oh, hi, Daisy. Thanks for having me. I'm doing good. We've got a nice day and I've got a house full of dogs and no sugar.
Yes, you really have got a house full of dogs. How many did you say you've got at the moment? Six?
Seven at the moment.
Wow.
So, yeah, quite a lot.
That is a house full.
Yeah, one's on her way to a new home tomorrow. So I'll be down to six tomorrow.
Yeah, that's going to be a difficult day. How long has she been with you?
Ava's been with me 6 months.
Wow.
Very difficult to let go.
Very difficult. Yes, we were talking before we started. I'm not sure I could do it. I mean, I could do the 6 months, but I couldn't do the I couldn't do the tomorrow giving her to somebody else part, I don't think.
The worst bit is putting her on the transport and she doesn't know what's happening to her. She has no clue she's going to her new home.
Oh, so they don't come and pick her up?
No.
From you.
She'll be bewildered and upset. And then she'll arrive at a home with humans she's never seen before and she'll be scared. But once they get over that and get through it, then everything's usually wonderful for them. But I go through hell.
Yeah, they are very resilient, actually. I think they're more resilient than we give them credit for sometimes.
Yes, I'd agree with you. They adapt. And they're a very highly successful species, so clearly they can adapt, and they're adapted to every country all around the world. So highly adaptable species, they get there. But I see the individual.
So absolutely.
Every dog's their own dog.
Well, I think people can probably tell that we are both dog lovers. People also, if they've been listening the last month or so, will be familiar with your name because I've mentioned you a few times. You've been helping me greatly with Rocket and his anxiety problems. And I've also mentioned that I was going to get you on the podcast to talk about you and to talk about dogs and talk about all the things you do. We've had some conversations already when you've been helping me with Rocket, and I've been itching to record a conversation with you so I can share it with other people who I know will be just as interested as I am. And we did have a brief discussion before we started recording about the best place to start. And I don't know what the best place is to start is because you've got a keto story, or as you told me, a sugar addiction story, which I'm very interested to hear about. And I'm also interested to hear about the dogs, of course. So I don't know where you want to start. Maybe, I guess, right back in the beginning when you first trained as a dog trainer. Was that something that we've had some conversations about this and the length of time you've been working with dogs. Was this something that you always wanted to do? Was this the first thing you went into, or were you doing other things to start with? What led you down the dog training track in the first place?
I was doing all sorts of things, and my parents, as a child, my parents wouldn't let me have a dog until I was a responsible child. So 14, 15 was the first dog. And of course, I loved dogs. I started doing little bits of training with her, but parents also insisted I went and got a proper education and got a proper job. And dog training isn't a proper job. So they sent me off and I did some training and I went into working in theatres. But they couldn't stop me working with dogs, so I ran that alongside. And I used to be the trainer at the local dog club. I passed all their tests to become a trainer there and ran the classes. And then eventually the person handed it over to me. And I did that for many, many years. But unfortunately, I did it very, very badly and quite wrongly, and I harmed dogs in the process.
So elaborate on that, because I know you told me a little bit about that, but when did you realise and how did you realise that you'd been doing it wrong? Because knowing you and knowing what you've just shared, you obviously adore dogs. So you clearly wouldn't have knowingly been doing it badly at the time. So presumably you thought it was right when you were doing it.
I did. I didn't realise there was any other way. It was a shock when I found out that there was another way. I was using punitive measures. So I was using techniques and equipment even that was harmful to dogs, things like choke collars, things like pinching ears, things like pushing them into position, a lot of quite coercive strategies to get them to do what I wanted them to do. And it was generally accepted that that was the way that you train dogs. And then I found out that all this was very bad in when I went and started my degree in canine behaviour and training in 2008.
And so what led you to do that? You just wanted to learn more about your craft?
No.
What led you to do the degree?
There was a bit of a transition going on for about 10 years where I realised, I'd come to realise that what I was doing was wrong, but didn't know how to get it right.
Well, you realised it was wrong because of the results you're getting, your gut feeling. What was
gut feeling?
Right.
The thing is, these methods work. The punitive methods will always work when you're training dogs.
Mm.
But I knew there was a cost somewhere to the dog, and I couldn't actually work it out where that cost was coming from and where it was paid. So, of course, I started reading, and the more I read, the more I realised I was right. And I wanted to know more. So in that 10 years, I transferred over into positive reinforcement training, then went and did the degree, which actually just, when you've researched and done much, much more research, I was right. You know, all the evidence is there that the punitive methods hurt dogs and that the kinder, fairer methods might be a little bit slower with their results, but they actually are good for dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, they're good for owners as well,
mm.
because the result is great. It's win-win for both. And the dog-owner bond is strengthened, whereas using punitive measures, it's not.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was a journey.
Yeah, it's kind of obvious, really. You shared a very interesting book with me that I think everyone really should read if they've got an interest in learning more about the relationship between themselves and their dogs. The Culture Clash by Jean Donaldson. Have I got that right?
That's right.
Very interesting book. I found that, you know, a lot of it seems so obvious, especially if you feel like you have that empathetic relationship with your dogs already. But I certainly learned a great deal from it. She writes very well and provides very good illustrations to get you to understand what's going on from the dog's point of view.
Absolutely. It is a great book. And I agree. Most people have a dog and never actually read a good book about dogs or concerning dogs. Usually if they read a book, it's a breed information book. And this book is great for every dog's parents to read. And I firmly believe, like you, that they should.
Mm.
You know, and I pass it on all the time. I try as much as possible to get people to read things that good books about dogs, books that are based in science and evidence, as well as empathy and symbiosis.
Mm-hmm. And so you had a pretty dramatic about face then. I mean, tell us about that. I mean, you went as far as putting an ad in the local paper, didn't you?
I did, yes. I was so embarrassed. And actually, the embarrassment wasn't about the people or for me. It was the fact that I'd hurt so many dogs. And while I hadn't hurt them directly, you know, I'm not thumping them or pushing them, it was a long-term drip, drip, drip punitive training that had hurt them. And even though all the owners got results, it horrified me. And the dog training class that I ran at the time, I actually wanted to reach everybody that I'd worked with in the previous 10 to 12 years. So I did. I put an ad in the local paper saying, please come and get your money back, or I'll retrain your dogs, or I'll train your new dog for free. And even that wasn't big enough atonement. You know, it's all about atonement now, as far as I'm concerned. So it wasn't enough. So I've had to do more to atone for being such a bad dog trainer. But I try. And very few people came forward, actually. A lot of people rang me about the ad and said, don't worry, you know, we actually will always come back to you. But nobody actually took me up on it. But I was fully prepared to give everyone their money back. Fully prepared.
Mm. Where does Spain come in?
Ah, I've been going to Spain for about 25 years on a regular basis. And combination of things, really. Eventually, I bought a little house there, high in the mountains, in an agricultural village. And in this village, there are hunters with Podencos mainly, but also Galgos as well, the greyhounds. So it became part of the landscape when I was there. I would see these dogs going out hunting, and I would see the conditions. And also traveling around Spain and the islands, I saw more. And it was a bit like drip feed. You see it enough times, it upsets you enough times. It stirs you enough, you then start to crusade.
Mm.
And I've been on that crusade for a long time, yeah.
I think possibly the Spanish hunters treat their dogs even more badly than the French hunters treat their dogs, if that's possible. I'm not sure if that's true, but from certainly
so.
From things that I've seen. And I mean, I have to say that I couldn't stand the local hunters. They used to drive me mad. I mean, they were, well, I won't go on a massive rant about it, but anyone who's seen me post about them knows how much I despise them. I mean, it was just this macho bullshit, basically, that I couldn't stand. And one of the worst things about it was they not only mistreated other people's dogs, make sure to keep your animals in when the hunters are out because they will shoot them. And I know people who lost their pets that way, but they mistreat their own dogs, which, to be honest, I could never understand the logic of that, because they're there to help you with your hobby. So how come you treat them so? I could just couldn't get the logic, but they did treat them really badly. A lot of the dogs that I saw were either chained up or kept in small kennels. The only time they got to go out was when they went hunting. They were poorly fed. You know, there was this logic that they would hunt better and all the rest of it. I mean, it was just awful. They frequently lost their dogs. And if you ever came across one of the hunting dogs, they were always nervous as hell. You know, you could never catch them to try and get them back to their owner. You know, even if you'd wanted to. But yeah, I really didn't like the French hunters, but from what I've seen and read, Spanish hunters treat their dogs even worse. Hey, this is editor me jumping in to give you that warning I mentioned in the introduction, that we're going to be spending the next few minutes talking about the plight of dogs in Spain and how appallingly they are treated by the Spanish hunters. The images conjured by Janine are extremely distressing. So if that's something that's going to stay with you and really bother you, then I suggest you skip forward about 3 or 4 minutes and you'll be safely on the other side.
That is very true. And a lot of Brits are now aware of the end of hunting season call.
Right.
The hunters will hang the dogs from the trees.
Wow.
These are mainly pointers, Podencos, Galgos, but a few other hunting breeds it happens to as well.
So why is that? They just can't be bothered to keep them for the non-hunting season? Because I have to say that, I mean, certainly around me, the French didn't go to that extreme.
Yeah, there's thousands of them hung. It's a bit traditional. It's a bit about not feeding them through till the next hunting season and just keeping what they need through the non-season just for themselves. But also the traditional element, there's a huge amount of that in there, because if the dog's had a good, if he's been a good dog through the season, they'll hang him so he dies quickly. If the dog hasn't been such a good dog, they'll hang him so it takes several days for him to die, and he's usually fly blown and maggot ridden. and his internal organs are eaten before he's dead.
Wow.
That is how bad it is. And the others that aren't hung are thrown down gorges. So steep gorges, they'll throw them down. There's no water in there. There's no food. They break bones on the way down and they die a horrific death. The photographic evidence you can find all over the internet, should you wish to. I would guard against it. It is horrific. But you'll see the way the dogs die. They die with grimace on their face. And it's haunting.
Mm.
And, of course, there's a lot of Brits in Spain that can't cope with this.
Mm.
So we start rescuing. The alternative for the hunter is to take the dog to the pound and hand the dog in. So the hunter has a choice. He can hang his dogs. He won't use a bullet. You know, there is no way he's going to use a bullet.
Mm.
So he can hang the dog, throw it down a gorge, or he can let it go. But what happens if they let them go is they start to come back, because the dog knows nothing else. It's conditioned to that life and it will hang around the doorstep until eventually the hunter will take it out and leave it in a motorway somewhere.
Mm.
So that's the choices, really. Let the dog go, hang it, or throw it down a gorge.
Mm.
So, yeah, it is quite bad. And that's why there's a lot of rescue from Spain.
Yeah, that's, gosh, I mean, yeah, that's even worse than I thought it was. But yeah, I've seen some of the pictures of dogs who have been rescued, you know, so I know that a lot of them come in literally broken and are put back together. I mean, I feel that the two that I have from Spain were lucky just to be street dogs.
Yeah.
Really, really lucky. And they have enough issues. I'm not entirely sure, actually, that Amy was definitely, her and her brother were just street dogs. They were taken off the street very, very young. I'm not sure about Rocket. I think he might have hunted at some point, whether just for his own ends or with hunters, I don't know, because he has much more of a strong prey drive than she does. But yeah, I mean, he didn't come in pieces. He was trapped off the streets, but still very, very anxious. So you mentioned you went on a crusade. I'm imagining from what you're saying, as distasteful as it is, if you can make it more appealing, if you can make it easier for hunters to drop their dogs off at a rescue place than do the alternative, which is horrific, they're more likely to do that than go down one of those other routes. Is that one of the strategies that you use? Right.
Make it easy for the hunter to hand the dog in.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, why not even give him a little payment for handing the dog in?
Mm.
Make it worth his while to hand the dog in. So for several years, I tried to instigate letting hunters know what was available to them and trying to persuade, just in my local area, trying to persuade them to use the local pounds. And to a degree, it worked. And at the same time, teaching children about good methods of keeping dogs, because the education needs to start with the children. The thing I've seen is, as a result of talking to the children about how dogs should be kept for hunting and how they need to be comfortable to hunt, and talking of comfort for a dog is something, a concept they didn't understand at all. They couldn't understand that a dog would hunt better if he slept on a mat than he would if he slept on a concrete floor, because his bones would hurt less. He would be able to go faster. And if he got good food, that would feed his system. So the children, over the years, have actually learned that. And it's become, I see dogs in my village, and it's become much more prevalent now to see dogs in comfortable collars, not baler twine.
Mm.
And that is a big, big move forward. No, that is huge.
And you accredit that mostly to the children, do you? That education from an early age. So you're paying the long game there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're waiting for them to grow up and turn into hunters.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I think we have to realise we can't stop the hunting.
No, that must be the difficult thing, because the natural inclination would be to want to go on a crusade and just stop it happening altogether. But of course, you're not going to get the result you want by doing that, are you?
No.
It must have been very, very difficult to have to work with people like that.
Yeah, you kind of have to take a step back and make sure that every single sentence you say is about being an advocate for the dog. And that way you have to hold your tongue, keep your temper. And even when you get quite nasty statements, you still have to behave very, very professionally and behave, basically. And I'm not used to that. It was quite difficult for me, but I've learned. So I speak to quite a lot of the hunters now, and they wave to me. And I didn't ever attack them, not once. So we've had movement. And at the same time, a few pressure groups were developing as well. So that all helped. So dogs have a better deal. In 20 years, it's changed a lot. I see dogs better fed now. They still live on chains. We're not going to get by that one yet. And some of the, what they call there, the better Pudenko kennels, have 6-inch chains on their dogs. So some of them have permanent neck damage. By the time they're 3 years old, their neck damage can be quite severe. They don't see that because a dog after 3 years old is no use to them anyway. Doesn't matter. So these things are going to take longer because there's no, we've got to give the hunter a reason for doing stuff, anything that we want to change.
Well, I was going to say, you've got to be an advocate for the dog. That's obviously the most important thing. But you've also got to show the hunters that there's an advantage to them to treating, because unless you do, I mean, they're not going to care. If they cared, you know, if you were an advocate for dogs or not, they wouldn't be doing it in the first place, would they?
Correct.
If they cared about the dogs, they wouldn't be interested. But yes, showing them, this is why I couldn't understand, as I said before, I couldn't understand the logic of mistreating your dogs, because they're not going to do as good job for you as they would do if you treated them just a little bit better. So I think that's as difficult and as distasteful as it would be, showing them the advantage to them actually treating their dogs a little better is the only way to go, really, isn't it?
It's just about beliefs. That's all it is. It's about the belief that the dog will hunt better if it's not fed for 3 days. And sadly, that's not the case, because the dog will be tired very quickly. It's not going to catch the right prey. So changing that belief and educating them is the only way. There is no other way.
So that was a long time then. And this is something you're still doing, is it? I mean, presumably you've struggled to go backwards and forwards with COVID. Yeah. I shouldn't imagine you've been for a while.
No.
But this is an ongoing project.
Yeah, it's kind of ended at the moment because everything stopped. But that's a good thing, because it's made me look at it again and see what else I can do now. Maybe it's time to move into another area.
Interesting.
Maybe it's time to do something different. Yeah. So that forced stopping of activities has actually been a good thing. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. But your rescue, is that based where you were in Spain? Is that somewhere else in Spain? How does that work?
The actual rescue itself is based in the UK.
Oh, right. Okay.
But all our dogs come from Spain. We will rescue any dog in need, but at the moment we're working in northern Spain, because very few people will take dogs from the northern pounds, and the conditions are even worse up there. But also in the islands, conditions on the islands are really, really bad too.
Right.
So we want to help those dogs. There are a lot of rescues helping the dogs in between.
I see.
So we are trying to plug a gap to an extent. On the islands, there is a lot of Pudenkos, plus other breeds, but there are a lot of Pudenkos. So that will be one of the main breeds from there. But in the north, they still have all the hunting breeds, including the Griffons, the Pointers, the Sabuesos, the Spanish Hounds. So all these dogs are the ones that we will be rescuing and are at the moment, yeah.
Oh, I see. So you don't actually have a physical rescue centre in Spain. You just pull from pounds and wherever you get them, and you bring them to the UK.
Yeah. Right?
I see.
They go into residence. They'll go into foster where they're prepared to travel. So during this time, they will get all their bloods checked for all the Mediterranean diseases. They'll be vaccinated against rabies and a cocktail vaccination for the UK. They also have to then go to have a titer test for the rabies. Then they go to the tracers kennels. So this takes 3 months.
Wow.
They then go to the Tracers Kennels for 48 hours before travel, where they're given a health certificate by the local vet. Then they go onto the van and then they travel to the UK. So it's quite long-winded, but as soon as they're out the pound, they are safe because the pounds are notorious for having a cull.
Right.
And they will, yeah.
Make some room.
Yeah, they get the name kill shelters from.
Right.
That's where that comes from. So they're not really there to help dogs that much, you know. It's somewhere to put them to keep them off the streets. And then when the pound gets full, they'll cull.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we get upset. You know, we know there's going to be a call happen and everyone goes in and pulls dogs out very quickly.
So what would you say to people? I've heard this criticism quite a few times from people who get dogs that have been rescued from other countries other than the UK, basically. You know, why should we be bothered about dogs in other countries? Why not just focus on rescues in the UK? You know, why do people get obsessed about, and I put myself in in these quote unquote people, but why do people get so interested in dogs from Spain or dogs from Bulgaria or dogs from China or all these other places when there are dogs mistreated on our own doorstep?
Okay. The level of trauma in the UK is a lot less than the level of traumatised dogs we see abroad. So the lives that the traumatised dogs abroad live are way, way worse. And if they get into a pound abroad, they're still in danger. Whereas a UK dog, most of us that live in the UK that's ever had a dog from a pound realise in a UK pound, it really is a proper shelter.
Mm.
They get a roof over their head. They get fed every day. They get toys. They get blankets. You know, that dog is going to be fine until he finds his home. This isn't the case with dogs from abroad. And that is why people move abroad or look abroad for their next pet, because they are so disadvantaged in comparison to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we've got this massive overbreeding in the UK. Through lockdown, of course, that got soaked up. But there is people breed dogs for money, you know. Nobody's going to breed a litter of dogs and give it away. They're not going to do it. And that is supply and demand, you know, and through lockdown, the demand got higher and higher and higher. And it did for rescue dogs too. But as a result of that, through lockdown, we've now got more dogs coming back into rescue in the UK. So I would say now there is the potential for that need to rescue in the UK, more so than there's ever been.
Mm.
So it is a question mark now, to be fair. And we've just taken a dog that he's in the UK already, and we are going to rehome him. So just because a dog is a UK dog, it doesn't stop us rescuing. We will do that if we were asked to. But it's predominantly the more disadvantaged dogs that people feel drawn to. They know what's going to happen to these dogs at the end of the hunting season. They know their lives are so short, so hard and so short, and people want to give them a life. That's it, really.
And of course, the other thing is that we fall in love with certain breeds. I mean, you laughed at me when we first started talking about Petenkos. You laughed at my naivety, having been used to lurchers. Well, you know, I've had lurchers in my family for quite a long time. I've owned a fair few lurchers, albeit not from troubled backgrounds. And I told you when I got Amy, who's, well, she's what I would call, a Petenko lurcher, because she's a mixture. Rocket is a pretty straight Petenko. But you laughed at me because I said, oh, hey, you know, they're just going to be another lurcher. They're a Spanish type lurcher. How different can they be? And you laughed because Petenkos, and I don't know about Galgos, are Galgos also that different? But Petenkos in particular, I mean, what I was getting at, I guess, to start with, was just saying we fall in love with particular breeds. So that's part of it, isn't it? Part of why you would start looking for dogs from Spain. I mean, I'd always want a Petenko now, for example.
Yeah, I guess so. Now you've lived with one and you know the benefits of having one. You also know the downsides. People go back for a second and a third, and some people end up with 8 or 9 because it's very hard with Petenkos because they are enigmatic.
Mm-hmm.
As a breed of dog, they are the chameleons of the dog world. They have the biggest, happiest, smiliest faces. They can string a human round their little paw. And Podencos are that dog. They're highly adaptable. They come into UK homes very easily and people adore them. And I'm one of those people as well. I love them. But they're not your typical sight hound. You're quite right. They have highly developed sense of smell, way, way more than any other sight hound. So you're getting both, really. You're getting a hunting sight hound. So that's double trouble. So you've got really high predatory drive too. And that usually takes people by surprise when they get their Podenco. And then when they see the Podenco in full hunting mode, that's another surprise. And then when they see the vertical takeoff and landing, there goes another surprise. So I love them. And once you've had one, you're right. You would always have another. And that is enough, really. You don't need to say much more about them. They sell themselves, don't they?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they're very beautiful. I mean, I get stopped all the time, people asking me about Rocket in particular. I mean, Amy's beautiful, as you know, but she's not as instantly recognisable as a Podenco because there's a lot of terrier in there as well. And interestingly enough, I think that mix of breed tempers the Podenco in her because she's very sensitive, but she's not sensitive like Rocket is.
Yeah.
And one thing that I noticed, the big thing that I noticed actually, the difference was the way they run, because I'm used to lurchers running. She runs like a lurcher. So she drops low and she runs and she sort of weaves as she runs. Rocket, on the other hand, very upright. It very much reminds me of those, you know, the show ponies that sort of prance and they're very upright, aren't they? Very upright, very straight line, and they bounce, 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 bounce. That's how they run. And that was the first thing that I noticed. Gosh, okay, you don't run like lurchers run. Very different. That was the first thing that showed me how different they were, actually, yeah.
Yeah, they do have very different ways of travelling.
Yeah.
And they do spend a lot of time in the air.
Yes. And that's something that people have remarked on. I mean, he is obsessed with squirrels. He just loves squirrels. And yeah, he will go into a vertical takeoff to try and jump and get them out of the trees. And he was making everyone laugh. A while back, this was before his latest anxiety problem, but he's getting back to the whole squirrel obsession thing. He stood on top of one of the picnic benches and did a vertical takeoff from there to try and get at the squirrels. But interesting, Amy's not interested in the squirrels at all. I find it fascinating how when you mix breeds, how much they start taking on the traits of the other breeds. I see so many similarities with her, with that sensitivity that you talk about, with that sensitive button that you talk about. But she's also so very different to him. And I think he's probably very typical of Podencos.
Oh, yes, I would say so. The sensitive button is quite important for Podencos. And that's very important for their humans as well. To understand it's there, what happens when it's thrown and tripped, and what happens to reset it. They're one of the very few breeds that has the level of sensitivity to that depth. It is sometimes amazing how deep that sensitivity runs. For a hunting dog, it's surprising.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about, because I think this presumably applies to all dogs, but it was particularly important for Rocket. It was the first thing that you told me about that we needed to fix the emotional bucket that they carry around with them.
When dogs experience stress or excitement that's perhaps not wonderful excitement that is a little bit about arousal and less about happiness.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that, actually.
Yeah.
Whether it was stress in good ways as well as bad ways.
Yeah.
If it's just the happy stress and excitement, like getting excited about squirrels, or, you know, where do you draw the line between where stress is good and bad when it comes to filling the emotional bucket up?
Well, that's all about the individual dog.
Uh-huh.
So one dog can be completely unstressed and still hunt the squirrel. But he's still got an elevation of some of his hormones to be able to hunt. Other dogs will be very stressed on even the sight of a squirrel if they've been trained on squirrels. So it's all about the individual. So most owners will work out what really freaks their dog out and what doesn't. And if the dog is exposed to the thing that makes them anxious, let's say out on a walk, something makes them anxious. Imagine that they're carrying a big bucket with them. And every anxious episode or everything that upsets them, which isn't a happy thing, will start to fill that bucket up with emotional water. Now, if that bucket gets full and starts overflowing, then the dog has tripped beyond being able to cope. His coping mechanisms have failed. And ideally, the best thing to do would be to take him home and let him sleep. Sleeping will empty that bucket and help him cope with life. But what happens in reality is that people take the dog out on a walk. It has an emotional episode. It fills the bucket. Further along on the walk, it has another one. The bucket's overflowing. And again, then they go home and the dog wakes up the next day with the bucket still half full. Mm. So within 10 minutes of being out, his bucket's overflowing again. And so on, until we reach a situation where it's going to take a week of sleep before the dog empties his emotions. Add to that the fact that the hole in the bottom of the bucket varies depending on the dog as well. So some dogs will empty quickly and some dogs won't. It's all about individuals again. That's why you can't use blanket protocols. Mm-hmm. You can use generic protocols to help dogs and then make them bespoke to each dog. So we all start with a general protocol to help this anxiety, which involves emptying that bucket, starting from scratch. So we're starting with a clean slate from the anxiety. And then we can work forward with each dog, whatever its problem is.
Yes, and I think people underestimate the variety of things that dogs can get stressed about. I know you're working with a friend of mine with her dog that she realised was getting overly anxious or obsessed about balls. She'd gone to a fly ball event, and since then her whippet was just really obsessed with balls. And I could see how he was getting with balls. You know, he would start barking when he saw one and get overexcited. And I think this is a very, very common thing, actually. I see it a lot with dogs and balls. They're overly, they just become obsessed with them. And, you know, to the point you can see that it's actually an anxiety problem. They quite often become aggressive with other dogs. Amy's been snapped at quite a few times by dogs who don't want her going anywhere near their ball. Thank you very much. That's actually a very common problem, I think, that people underestimate with something that is supposed to be fun.
Yeah. The ball is no longer fun for the dog now. So, yeah, you're quite right. We are currently desensitizing that particular dog to balls. We've spent just over 2 weeks emptying that bucket about balls by keeping the dog away from any balls. We're now introducing balls in a different way and in a way that the dog will have a coping mechanism, but also that the owner can actually control the dog when a ball is around. So we're going to drop that dog's obsession with balls right down as low as we can get it. We're going to let the dog have fun with other objects. And also eventually the dog will be able to have fun with balls again, but that won't be yet, you know, once we've got control. And you're right, it's very common. And unfortunately, dogs can die with this obsession. You know, they can swallow the ball. If there's a group of dogs and one dog wants to get the ball, then they can swallow that ball. And very often it will go in the trachea and they choke.
Yeah, I can see how that could happen. Yeah. I mean, I'm very lucky with Amy. Rocket doesn't know what to do with balls at all. He'll sometimes go up to it and sort of do something with his paw. And I really don't know what to do with that. And I can't be bothered. Amy learned because she watched other dogs playing with balls and thought, well, they look like they're having fun. There must be something in this. And I've gradually sort of taught her a bit about the whole, you know, going and getting the ball and bringing it back. And she, you know, she does it when she wants to play. And when she's had enough, she won't bring it back. And that's fair enough. It's very much, I can see the difference. She thinks it's quite good fun. She's not at all obsessed with it. If another dog comes along and wants to take the ball, she's like, we'll have it then. I'm not going to get into an argument about it. And she enjoys it, but she can kind of take it or leave it.
Yeah.
Now that seems to me to be a fun, happy relationship with a ball that is not problematic. And it doesn't seem to be advancing outside those parameters, but it is something that I see, spot very quickly that it's a problem with a lot of dogs. I would say it's probably one of the most common issues, actually.
Can be. Obsession over objects can be a big issue with dogs, yeah.
And of course, it's something that can help with training as well. So it's one of these, yeah. But it's a very fine line, isn't it? And that's another thing that gets talked about in the Jean Donaldson book that we mentioned earlier.
Absolutely.
She talks about that, doesn't she?
Yep, you can move either side of that line very, very easily. You have to be very careful when using objects for training. Using treats for training, also, you stay close to that line. But it's a safer option than toys for most people.
Mm.
If you've got dogs that you know are likely to be highly toy-driven or ball-driven, then very often, unless you're a very experienced trainer, it's better to stick to the treats so you don't develop obsessions or trigger obsessions.
Well, as interesting as it is, talking about the specifics of Potenkos and dogs, I certainly find it interesting, but other people might be wondering when we're going to get to talking about a bit of keto, maybe. Thank you for staying with me right to the end. As always, we finish up with an end quote. And as we were talking about all things canine, I thought I would find an end quote that was on topic. There were quite a few to choose from, including some really lovely poems, and it ended up being quite a difficult choice. I've got two that I particularly like, so I'm going to use one this week and the other one next week. So this week's end quote is from Anatole France. Until one has loved an animal, a part of one's soul remains unawakened. Until next time, give your doggies a cuddle from me. Take very good care, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.